From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio, and joining me on the panel via Skype are Nahal Tuzi, foreign affairs correspondent for Politico, and Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times. And here are the issues. As the coronavirus pandemic continues to advance through the world's population, doctors have embarked on an unprecedented effort to develop therapies and a vaccine. Some positive signs emerged for the early development of a vaccine, but the public's attention was diverted when U.S. President Donald Trump announced that he had been taking a drug that had been deemed ineffective and potentially harmful by researchers in his own administration. President Trump continued his assault on the World Health Organization, threatening to permanently halt U.S. funding if changes were not made in short order. The Trump administration announced much-needed funding for programs to bolster the food supply in the U.S. and for the development of drugs to battle COVID-19, but remained opposed to funding critical states hit hardest by the costs associated with the pandemic. In the latest of a series of firings, President Trump dismissed another of the inspectors general that provide independent oversight of the government. Elected officials in both parties are questioning the latest instance, calling it a case of improper retribution for proper oversight. And in Paris, authorities apprehended a key Rwandan figure accused of aiding and abetting the horrific massacre of Hutus and Tutsis in 1994. Panelists, welcome to the show. Thank you for your talents and professionalism remotely rather than in our Voice of America studios. Let's start off with COVID-19 and the science behind it. A private biotech company, which partnered with the National Institutes of Health to develop a vaccine, announced that volunteers receiving a test vaccine had some positive early results. And in addition, some universities in the UK have also made advances. This effort is going on around the world. I'll start with you, Josh. What are the doctors saying about the current status of a vaccine? How much progress have we made? And is there a likelihood of meeting the U.S. president's ambitious goal of a vaccine by the end of 2020?
Michael, you know, there's a lot of, obviously a huge amount of hope and money and time being invested in a vaccine, but I think we probably shouldn't get too ahead of ourselves. There were some positive signs this week. Moderna, a biotech company based in Cambridge, Massachusetts, showed some positive responses. They showed that their vaccine that they're testing protected mice from lung infections. There was a big surge in the stock market. But meanwhile, in Oxford, which is another vaccine that people are pinning a lot of hopes on, there were slightly more disappointing results. They were testing on monkeys, and they showed that after giving them the vaccine, there was still a huge amount of it present in their nose swabs. So, you know, mixed results across the board. Really, the hunt for a vaccine, even if, say, the Moderna vaccine came through, most scientists are estimating that it would still be 12 to 18 months before you could have it on the mass market. So the politicians' predictions, and it's not just the president, to be fair, the British government's also been very bullish on this, that we might have some widespread vaccines by the end of the year. I think very much on the hard optimistic side of what's realistic here.
And now the announcements that were made by a private company boosted, as Josh said, a run on their stock. It went up by tremendous amounts, but there were no published results. Is there an issue here about private companies and other efforts announcing some successes without publishing actual results so that there can be clinical and professional scrutiny of exactly what's going on with the trial?
Yeah, I mean, the move to do that basically via a press release that said, hey, we had some good results, but didn't include the science or, you know, the real details of what they had done, that drew a lot of criticism from scientists and others, and some of whom did note, look, yeah, it was nice for them to suddenly get a jump in their stock. But until we see the actual science behind this, it seems like it was more like a PR stock stunt than anything else. And, you know, it's really important to point out that while we are across the board trying to find a vaccine, we're still also trying to understand the coronavirus. I mean, there's still researchers trying to figure out exactly what this virus does. And every day we learn something new, for instance, that it's not just the lungs that are getting damaged, that it's attacking other parts of people's bodies, that there are some younger people who are suffering from strokes that seem to be linked to it, and that there are children who are having symptoms of an inflammatory disease that may be linked to it. I mean, we're still trying to understand the disease at the same time that we're racing to find a vaccine for it. And that just means that there's just a lot of tenuousness out there about what really is possible and what isn't. And, you know, everybody wants this vaccine, and hopefully this company is right, and in the long run, we can get this vaccine. But if they're wrong in the long run, it could also damage them on the business front.
And I'll stay with you, Nihal, for this question. Obviously, there's an international effort to develop this vaccine. No matter who the winner is the country that develops the vaccine likely or even bound in some way by international law to share that vaccine at no cost to the other nations of the world? How does this solution work in terms of a global solution?
So there's no international treaty or law or anything that says that there has to be sharing. This is very much a capitalistic approach across the board. There have been efforts led by the European Union and others, the World Health Organization, to try to have coordination. And there have been some claims, like the Chinese, for instance, have said, oh, yes, of course, we'll share it with the world. But nobody is making really solid promises on pricing or it being free. And India, for instance, has had people say, leaders say, well, no, we'll have to, of course, you know, give it to Indians first. And the United States has been totally, very largely absent on this coordination effort globally. It's not taking the lead. And the president's Operation Warp Speed, which is this big push to find this vaccine, one of the main tenets of it has been that the goal is to vaccinate most, if not all, Americans by the end of this year. But again, it's Americans. So yeah, there's very much a concern that there's going to be a race for this and that people are going to be left out, that developing countries are not going to be able to afford a vaccine when it comes on the market. At the same time, people are saying, look, we need to have some sort of prioritization. For instance, healthcare workers across the world really should be first in line to get these vaccines.
It's interesting to me this week that as we have this discussion about the advancement and the development of a vaccine and therapies for COVID-19. You had President Trump making a stunning announcement, almost as an aside, that he is taking a drug called hydroxychloroquine, a malaria drug, I believe, that's been deemed dangerous, really, for use in an uncontrolled and inappropriate way by the doctors of the Food and Drug Administration, a part of the Trump administration. I'll go back to you, Josh. This sort of collision between science and the president's gut feeling about aspects of science, this sort of highlights that collision point there. Why is it significant that he made this announcement, and what are the ramifications of it?
You know, I think the hydroxychloroquine thing, a lot of it is a fight, and it's a fight between Trump and the media. And I think the president in many ways is a troll. I think he really likes winning arguments. He clearly has the fixation with this drug, but part of his fixation is the huge amount of criticism he's taken for banging on about it. So him and the media are slightly locked in this death debate around hydroxychloroquine that frankly isn't that useful to the rest of the country or the world. And it's really unhelpful of the president to keep banging on about it. But frankly, you know, it's not that dangerous. It's obviously a drug that is used for malaria and lupus. It's probably not doing him any harm. He's being given it by a doctor. And frankly, the whole thing is an enormous distraction. It's obviously extremely eye-opening when the president announces in the middle of a press conference that he's taking this anti-malarial drug that isn't necessarily that helpful for the COVID-19, although, you know, some doctors are giving it a try here and there. But frankly, it's hard to ignore the president at the best of times. But I really think that this debate is just not helpful for anyone. And it's just a blind alley that a lot of time and effort is being expended upon.
There is an argument for that. Then on the other hand, there were earlier announcements and pronouncements about seeking ways to use cleansers as a treatment for COVID-19 and light in the body and that sort of thing. And I would position it as it's a battle between the doctors, the science, who are saying that this is a dangerous thing, and the media is just reporting what the doctors are saying. The media does not make a diagnosis or determination about the safety of anything. But I would say that when you look at, and I'll stay with you, Josh, for this, when you look at Trump, who now seems to be in some conflict with members of his administration who produce these science and the safety of things and appropriate procedures, like the Center for Disease Control Director Robert Redfield, that leaves the public in a situation where they have to decide who to trust. Where does that fall out now?
You know, the old saying is that people take the president seriously, but not literally. I mean, some people do take him literally, and it's a problem, obviously. But at the same time, you know, I work in a newspaper, and, you know, we ran a huge page of articles on this, which I was annoyed about because, frankly, I don't think it's that important. It's obviously a problem that the president is a crank, and that the president has ideas about science and thinks he's right and doesn't always listen to people who are far better qualified than him. But the truth is, it's not like millions of people around America are, you know, taking hydroxychloroquine. And even if they were, it probably wouldn't do any great damage. So I do think, while we can't ignore the president, we would probably do our best to dampen down the implications of this, because I don't think it does anyone any favors to shout it from the rooftops.
And Nahal, I'll give you the last word on this. Who do we trust? Who does the public trust, the doctors or the president?
I think it depends on which members of the public. When you look at the polls, people are so partisan in the United States that some of them trust the president as much, if not more, than they trust Dr. Anthony Fauci and other top scientists who are involved in this. I, for one, am not entirely convinced that the president actually is taking this drug. The statement that his physician put out, you know, it did not specifically say that he had given him this drug and that the president was taking it. So I don't really know what's going on. It's not what the scientists in general recommend.
In situations like this, it's confidence that changes the day and wins the day. And that's what really the issue is. Like, where does confidence come from for the public in when it comes to what to take and how to take it? Let's move on to the World Health Organization. President Trump threatened to permanently halt funding for the World Health Organization if it doesn't commit to, quote, substantive improvements, unquote, within 30 days. On Monday, the administration sent a letter to WHO Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus outlining the U.S.'s grievances about the WHO's handling of the coronavirus pandemic and warned, if the WHO does not commit to major substantive changes within the next 30 days, I will make my temporary freeze of the United States funding to the WHO permanent and reconsider our membership. Josh, what does President Trump want from the WHO? What would be considered substantive improvements?
Well, it's a very good question. The letter is quite detailed in its critique of the WHO and pretty vague in terms of its demands. There has been some suggestion that Dr. Tedros could step down. He's considered a puppet of the Chinese, at least by the Trump administration. More broadly, what their goal is, or their stated goal, is to reduce Chinese control over the WHO. You know, given that America is by far and away its largest funder, I think Trump feels, not entirely unreasonably, that America should probably have the biggest say at the table. And there is some valid anger with the WHO and the way that they operated in February and March and took the Chinese at their word on a lot of information that has turned out to be hugely false and hugely damaging to the world in terms of transmission and danger posed by the coronavirus. So there is a valid critique here. But what the president actually wants is not that clear, other than this rather nebulous sense that the Chinese are having too much influence at the WHO. So maybe they push Dr. Tedros out. Maybe, you know, he's a sacrificial lamb, or there's some sort of gesture they can make to the Americans to keep their funding. They're going to have to do something. Otherwise, well, the Chinese have offered to step forward with the money, but, you know, then you're sort of doubling down on China. I wouldn't want to be working for the WHO right now in their funding or press department, because they're in a bit of a confusing but definitely quite dangerous situation.
Indeed, especially in the midst of a pandemic,
right,
to have this sort of turmoil going on. No, I think my research concluded that China currently contributes less than 10% of the U.S. contribution. So it raised my eyebrows as to how and why China would have currently more influence than the U.S. at those funding levels. Based on that question, I want to ask you, are the grievances legitimate? Is this political scapegoating, or is a little bit of both?
As usual, it's a little bit of both, somewhere in the middle. I mean, if you look at the WHO's initial response, it did seem like they were a bit too friendly to the Chinese and a bit too willing to believe them. At the same time, they were pretty on the ball, and they were much faster as a whole, as an organization, than the United States was in recognizing the danger of the virus. And the other thing to remember about all this is, you know, in terms of Chinese influence, first of all, they say that the Dr. Tedros, like, one of the reasons he got the job was because he had the support of so many African countries, as well as Chinese government has a lot of influence over a number of African governments, and there are a lot of Chinese officials who work at the WHO. So that is part of the influence. At the same time, we have to remember that the WHO is a multinational organization. So when we say you need to do this, it's sort of like saying we need to do this, and that we also includes other countries, including China. So if we want WHO reform, the Chinese are going to have to go along with it, as are any number of other countries that align one way or another with the US or China. You know, a 30-day deadline is just not very realistic. These things take months, if not years, to push through at a multinational level.
We'll take a break right there. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on VOA's website at voanews.com. Now back to our panel via Skype, Nahal Tuzi, foreign affairs correspondent for Politico, and Josh Glancy, Washington bureau chief for the Sunday Times. Let's move on to the, I want to call it the use of the power of the purse by the Trump administration, used to influence policy and politics and the balance between the two. Trump announced a $19 billion program for farmers and ranchers in the United States to protect the nation's food supply chain and the livelihoods of those said farmers and ranchers because of the effects of the pandemic, and also signed, I believe, a $354 million contract with another company to produce COVID-19 drugs. Both of these things are good and needed. At the same time, the administration has declared that it is against funding for the states that are hit badly by the pandemic, and the governors are saying this is badly needed to bridge budget shortfalls because of decreased revenues and increased costs during the pandemic. The president is even threatening to withhold unspecified funds from Michigan, the state of Michigan, for their plans to initialize a voting by mail in their state. I'll start with you, Josh. Obviously, advancing drug production, protecting the supply chain, good things. Oversight for these programs and your thoughts on the careful use of the power of the purse by the administration. Is it fair, or is it a little more focused on politics than policy?
Well, I think everything in this administration is slightly more political than it probably ought to be. It's certainly true that the American Farm Bureau is very close with the administration, as you might expect, given the strength of the Republican Party in various farming states. And Zippy Duval, their president, is a direct line to the Oval Office. Obviously, the food supply chain does need protecting, but it is pretty clear with the president that he sees the public purse as something of a tool to wield over those beneath him. And his fight with Michigan is unseemly. His obsession with mail voter fraud isn't backed up by any research or facts. And frankly, you know, Michigan, it doesn't really seem like particularly good politics to me, because Michigan is one of, if not the critical state in the fall. So launching an attack on it now isn't necessarily in his best interest. So yeah, and you know, equally with New York, we know that Trump has a very complex relationship with New York and feels quite scorned by his old home. And any opportunity to sort of kick the likes of Andrew Cuomo and Bill de Blasio and the city that rejected him, Trump's likely to take. But, you know, as ever with Trump, as with the hydroxychloroquine, there's a lot of posturing. Doesn't necessarily mean these funds will be withheld or that they're being misused. One has to, you know, separate some of the rhetoric from the reality. But it certainly isn't how we would expect a president to go about behaving at the best of times, never mind during a pandemic.
No, I'll pose the same question to you. Picking the Trump administration, picking winners and losers, good policy, good politics, where does it fall out on that spectrum?
I think when it comes to the supply chain and farmers, et cetera, in a sense, it's good policy in the eyes of both Democrats and Republicans, who, generally speaking, across the board, feel increasingly aggrieved with China, because a lot of this is about getting our supply chains and other types of reliance on China reduced. Now, when it comes to the farmers, that is a critical voting block for President Trump. And so he wants to protect them. And they have already, before the coronavirus, they were really suffering because of the trade war with China. So he has given them billions in a bid to maintain their allegiance ahead of his reelection, which is the other thing I wanted to mention, which is the mail fraud allegations, which, again, like has been said, there's no evidence for the voter mail fraud allegation. But you could argue that the president is making these claims now in a bid to muddy the waters ahead of the election, so that if he does end up losing, that he can make claims that the election was fraudulent.
Josh, I'll go back to you. How did the president make this balancing going forward? Clearly, he's in election mode and probably has been for his entire administration. But is there anyone who can break through and make reasonable determinations between what's political and what's right to do as the president of the United States?
Well, I'll say one thing, which is I don't think he's going to get too many favors from Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan, who is a pretty tough cookie. But, you're quite right. This year is all politics, really. Everything has November in mind. Everything we write as journalists is with an eye to the election. And I think Nahal's right that there is a narrative being set up in advance about the election itself, the integrity of the election itself, on both sides, I should say, but particularly from the president, that is worrying for American democracy. And I think we're just going to have to buckle up, frankly. You know, the president is all politics all the time.
Let's move on to the IG, the Inspector General, firing. President Trump fired State Department Inspector General Steve Linnick, the fourth Inspector General to be removed or targeted for removal by the president in the past 3 months. IGs are Senate-approved watchdogs that are responsible for independent oversight within the government. They were established as a result of Watergate as a means of, again, oversight and maintaining integrity within the individual departments, the administration. Josh, does the president have the legal right to do this? The answer to that is probably yes. But is it, again, the right thing to do? What actually prompted the president to take this move against this particular inspector general?
Well, as we've learned through the course of this presidency, there are actually quite a lot of things that the president has the right to do, but we have the expectation that he wouldn't. Trump has pushed those boundaries from day one. The story, and this is still unspooling, but it appears that he was asked by the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, that recommended that he fired Linick. And so he did. Why Secretary Pompeo recommended that is now the subject of some quite fierce speculation and analysis. There are indications that he was unhappy about being investigated over various things, such as getting staff to walk his dog and prosaic things like getting them to pick up his dry cleaning, but also signing off on arms sales to Saudi Arabia, using public funds to host very lavish dinners at the State Department that maybe were more in service of his own political ambitions than the country's. So there is certainly the suggestion that President Trump was doing his close ally Mike Pompeo a favor, and that Mike Pompeo wanted this guy fired because he didn't like what he was trying to turn up.
And Nahal, the president does, as Josh suggested, have the right to do this. He is legally within his bounds, but in terms of propriety, it is questionable, to say the least. The president seems pointed towards the remainder of this administration, at least, to have an administration without independent oversight within the legal system, Supreme Court. Is there anything that anyone can do about a president that does not want oversight of his administration?
There are still some watchdog organizations out there. There's still the media. There are still people who can uncover and point to wrongdoing. But will the president be held accountable? Look, at the end of the day, it comes down, for the most part, to Congress to do that. That's the way the system has been set up. But what we're learning is that in a deeply partisan country, if a political party that has power over a particular branch works with another branch, with the political party in that branch, that can completely circumvent and undermine the idea of separation of powers and checks and balances. So if the Republican Party, which controls the Senate and Congress, is unwilling to hold President Trump accountable because he is a Republican president, then there's not much that's going to happen. And you could argue that the courts could weigh in at a certain point, but the courts don't really have any enforcement powers. They can just make a ruling. And if Congress and the president don't respond to that, then no.
Well, very quickly, as we end, I wanted to mention that Felicien Kabuga, a key Rwandan genocide fugitive, appeared in a Paris court days after police had captured him in his hideout in the suburb of the French capital. The 84-year-old is accused of financing Hutu militias that massacred some 800,000 Tutsis and their moderate Hutu allies over a span of 100 days in 1994, a place I was within 24 hours of being there the day the massacre started. Nahal, just very quickly, I guess what I ask, what happened, what took so long, and what's next in this, very quickly?
Well, apparently Kabuga had been living under aliases for decades, and his children, his family members had basically been protecting him. Over time, you know, there was not as much attention paid to the case as probably there could have been. I read one account that said that basically because of the COVID crisis, other active investigations were kind of put on hold. So the French had more time to look at this particular case. They worked with the Belgians and the London police, and they all got together and realized that they could track this person based on tracking his children. And when they basically homed in on a particular address, and they were able to find him. Now, he's elderly, I believe he's in his 80s, and these types of court processes, especially when they involve an international court, take a long time, very long time. There's all sorts of procedures and things like that. And in the long run, I don't know if he's going to make it to where they will convict him or anything like that. But still, the fact that in the end, they didn't give up and they found him and they are going to try to pursue justice, that is really important message to send to people who, you know, want to pursue and perpetrate atrocities in the future.
Yeah, it does at least have a whiff of justice about it. Glad to see that. That is all the time we have for today. Thanks to Nahal Tuzi, foreign affairs correspondent for Politico, and Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times. This program is produced by the Voice of America, and I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.